to celebrate this amazing phenomenon of spring migration, to highlight the diversity, not to give you a treatise. There are many treatises out there, books, PhD dissertations. Migration has been one of the most studied aspects of bird biology. So I'm more interested really in celebrating this incredible phenomenon. And, you know, birds aren't the only animals that migrate, but I would argue that they are the champions. There is no animal, no creature on Earth that migrates more spectacularly than birds. As a matter of fact, the champion of all is the Arctic tern, which migrates from its Arctic nesting grounds to its Antarctic wintering grounds and back every year. It's remarkable. So I'm just going to give you the briefest of overviews about migration. Really, you know, what is migration? I could give you a textbook sort of definition. It's a regular, recurrent, seasonal movement of populations from one geographic area to another, quite simply, and then back. It's migration is a behavior which is programmed, genetically coded into a bird's behavior. Some birds are obligatory migrants. They migrate no matter what. Other species are more what you might call facultative migrants. They'll migrate in some years. They'll migrate further in some years than others. But many of the birds that we're talking about today are what we would call obligate migrants. They migrate every year from Vermont or New Hampshire to their wintering grounds, which can range from only a couple of hundred miles away to many thousands of miles away. And basically, migration is a quest on the part of the birds to find favorable environmental conditions year-round. Needless to say, if you're an insect-eating bird nesting in Vermont, you're not going to do very well surviving on that diet during the winter. So insect-eating birds almost invariably seek those food resources elsewhere during the winter in warmer climes. It's an incredibly perilous thing to do, to migrate. There are many, many hazards that birds face during their migrations, from bad weather, which can throw them off course, collisions with objects, be they towers, be they windows on tall buildings, cats, avian predators, many, many things can go wrong for a migratory bird, a bird in the act of migrating. So it's something that evolution has favored over time because the benefits that the birds gain by passing part of the year in an area where they have favorable conditions. Oh, I'm getting an echo in with my voice. Is there any way to? Oh,
yeah, I'll figure out who's unmuted.
It's gone. Thanks. Okay. Anyway, of the roughly 300 species of birds that occur in Vermont, I don't have an exact number about how many are migratory, but the great majority of them are. Certainly two-thirds of the birds that nest here in Vermont are not here during the winter. And those are the ones we'll talk about today. And so it's just it's a dazzling spectacle. I mean, look at this slide here of these migrant birds, many of which are back now. I haven't seen a Canada warbler, the upper right, yet, but the other three, the rose-breasted grosbeak, lower right, scarlet tanager, and Baltimore oriole, they're back, many of them, not all of them. Things are behind this year. The weather is one of the triggers for bird migration, although ultimately it's coded in the genes, the behavior itself. Weather is what dictates the actual movements of birds. And we've had a lot of north winds lately. I'm sure you've noticed that. And in the spring, birds are induced to migrate north by pulses of warm southerly air. And we haven't had many of those. Really, we've had only one significant event where we got a good south wind. That was about 10 days ago, the weekend before this past one. Now, we're going to get another one in a couple of days, and everybody's got to get out there then. I'll show you an image a little bit later that refers to that. So, many people that know me, I am an ornithologist, know that I'm a songbird geek. I have a significant passion for songbirds. I love all birds, but songbirds are the group that really drives my engine. So I'm going to focus on songbirds today for the most part. All right, I think I'm going to, and you know, it's May now. So May is the month for songbird migration in the Northern Hemisphere. It's just it's a bonanza. It's a parade of warblers, thrushes, tanagers, orioles, flycatchers, you name it. Somebody need to mute? Anyway, one of the things I want to say before getting into, I'm sure we're going to go through a little bit of the progression of migration during this season. Many may not know, although some of you certainly do, that nearly all songbirds are nocturnal migrants in that they actually do their migrating at night. And that nobody's exactly sure how that evolved. There are probably a number of factors responsible for it. One, I think, certainly is that songbirds are visual feeders, and they need to be able to see their food, mostly insects in this case, to capture and eat it. And because these migrations involve long, arduous flights, they take a tremendous amount of energy, and the reserves that the birds need to rely on to fuel those flights are gained by their food. So they need to feed during the day, and they've evolved to migrate at night under the cover of darkness. And there's a whole body of fascinating study literature on how birds navigate, how they orient and navigate. We're not going to get into that, but they do it, and they do it faithfully and reliably, and many birds return to the exact same spot, territory, in most cases, where they were the previous year. It's really stunning. But I'm digressing, so I want to get back to the topic at hand, which is the migration of songbirds. So I'm going to advance here. So naturally, early in the spring, I mean, the very first migrants, I think, that we're all become aware of are not songbirds. They are geese, Canada geese, and other waterfowl that start moving in February. But among the songbirds, certainly the harbinger that many of us wait restlessly for during those cold, dark months of January and February is the red-winged blackbird, which come back when snow's on the ground, the ponds they nest around are frozen. They appear, the males start singing, displaying, and they are the very first sign for most of us that spring is on the way. Not too far behind them, although not nearly as conspicuous, are the American woodcock, lower left, the timberdoodle, which are also a very hardy bird that come back often before the ground is thawed and undergo, and I hope many of you have witnessed this, and if you haven't, you must, and even if you have, you must again witness their spectacular courtship flights. The male woodcock, early in the spring, it's probably winding down now, at dusk and sometimes through the night, undergo a remarkable courtship flight where the males ascend in a sort of rising circle, making a twittering sound with their stiff outer wing feathers. And they get up to maybe 100, 150 feet and then sort of plummet back down to the ground, making a chirping sound. It's just if they do this in open areas adjacent to brushy habitat usually, and it's really one of the most amazing spectacles in the bird world, I think. And everybody should witness this at some point. So I hope that many of you have already this spring. Soon after the woodcock and redwings, the song sparrows appear, our first resident sparrow to come back from not too far away, most of them. In fact, some song sparrows eke it out here in the winter. They are considered a half-hardy species, and some of them will survive. They'll visit feeders. But now they're all back, singing lustily, filling up our hedgerows and shrubby habitats. And soon after them, a true insect-eating species, the eastern phoebe, arrives, the first flycatcher to come back, usually in mid-late March. Of course, arrival dates are getting earlier now for many of these species, with a warming climate. And now the phoebes are all back. They're nesting. I'm watching a couple of nests, locally, but they get back early, with their emphatic little song. Digress briefly. A couple of years ago, and I think this picture taken by Kent McFarland, who's probably lurking in the background somewhere here, we had an astounding experience down at Lake Runnymede in Windsor, Vermont, on a very cold, I think it was early April day. Kent, Spencer Hardy, and I went down there to do some birding. And we had a congregation of eastern phoebes there. I think we had about 150 eastern phoebes arrayed around the shore of Lake Runnymede, finding insects. It was very cold and bitter. These birds were stressed out, no question about that. And they were just concentrated around the shoreline trying to find insects. It was, I think, one of the largest phoebe congregations that's ever been documented. It was incredible. All right, so there are some of the early songbird migrants, although a woodcock is not a songbird, I will admit. Moving on. Then one of my favorite groups are the thrushes, which come back not super early, although the hermit thrush, upper left, is the earliest to come back. And thrushes are one of those groups that for many of us, when we hear them sing, send chills up our spine. The songs are haunting and melodic, and I just want to play them for you because I think there's such a signature sound of spring in the North Woods. So hermit thrushes arrive back first.
Chris, can I interrupt you for 1 second?
Absolutely.
A lot of folks are wondering which bird is which in the slides. And it would be great if you could just show them that, tell them that.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. I'm sorry. Upper left is the hermit thrush, our state bird, Vermont state bird, with its rusty tail. That's the best field mark on a hermit thrush. All of the thrushes are very similar in appearance. And one of the best ways to tell them apart, actually, is by hearing their songs or their calls. Most of you know, but I'll just state it, that male birds are primarily the ones who sing in songbirds. Occasionally females will, but generally it's the males. And they sing to proclaim and advertise a territory and to attract a mate. But also all species have a series of calls, call notes, much shorter, simpler notes that they use for social interactions. But I'm going to play you some of the songs of these four thrushes here, and I'll go through each one. But the very first one back is the hermit thrush. They're often quiet when they first arrive. It may take a week or even longer before they'll start singing, but they are singing now for sure. And I'm just going to use my iPhone, but I think it's going to work. So here's the hermit thrush, the Vermont state bird. It's got that flute-like ascending, beautiful. I think it's ethereal. And I'm just going to play another call that you might often hear a hermit thrush giving. It's called the way call. And both females and males will do that. And I've been hearing that in the woods around my house. So there's the hermit thrush. The next one back is often the wood thrush, which is the lower left, a little bit bigger than the hermit, comes a bit later, usually in early May, and is considered to be one of the most accomplished songsters in the songbird group. So I'm going to play you the wood thrush song. I'm sure many of you have heard this and are hearing it perhaps daily now. It's a complex song. And I also want to play you a call that some of you will hear of the wood thrush. It's some people call it the machine gun rattle. That's something you're likely to hear. Once nesting starts, and it, again, male or female can do it. I think it's something of an agitation call or a social interaction call. Okay, so there's the wood thrush, lower left. Now we're going to do the veery in the upper right, which is a very similar bird to the hermit thrush, a bit duller in coloration, duller brown, doesn't have the rusty tail, not quite as heavily spotted on the chest. But let's listen to the veery. It's got also in my mind, all these thrushes have beautiful, enchanting songs. I love that. I haven't heard it yet. Haven't heard one yet this year. And let me just play you this call of the veery, which is why it has the name veery. Veer. You'll often hear that at any time of day. All the thrushes tend to sing mostly at dawn and dusk. They're crepuscular birds. They tend to concentrate their activities, and particularly their vocal activities, in the evening and in the very early morning. Well, then the Swainson's thrush. Now, I have not heard of a Swainson's thrush on the lower right that anyone has found yet, but they're due, and if they're not here now, they will be any day. I guarantee you there'll be an influx this weekend. This may be arguably not quite as distinctive a song. It's more of a gurgling, ascending song. Here it is. That's more of a boreal bird. Tend to find it in conifer-dominated forests or on mountaintops. And then finally, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this one, the Bicknell's thrush, which is a bird of some special nature to VCE. We've been studying Bicknell's thrushes, which breed on our mountaintops only, for over 25 years. And they are probably not back yet. They are perhaps the latest of these thrushes to arrive back from their wintering grounds in the Caribbean. And I will play you the song. You need to be on a mountaintop to hear a Bicknell's thrush sing its song. And here it is. It's kind of a wild song that fits the habitat and the environment to me. Often swirling clouds and winds, and here's the bird singing. I'll be hearing that in 10 days or so. And I'm just going to play you the calls, which you're much more likely to hear. This is a bird that many people have not had close encounters with because it lives in these difficult to get to mountaintops. It's a somewhat secretive, furtive bird. Doesn't show itself, but you're often going to hear this call. Similar to the veeries in a way, nasal. All right, so there are the thrushes. To me, a group that is just the essence of spring and songbirds. However, we have to turn to the warblers. The warblers are in many people's minds, and I would have to classify myself among them, the sort of showstoppers of spring migration. It's a very diverse group. There are about 30 species that migrate back to or through Vermont, some of them heading further north to Canada and the boreal forests. But I just wanted to highlight a few of the early warblers that many of which are now here. The yellow-rumped warbler, upper left, is the classic early spring warbler, occurs in large flocks sometimes. Many of them have already moved through. They're still here, but the flocks are smaller now, and they're beginning to thin out. But they're a very cheerful bird. This is a male. Left.
Please turn off the noise.
Yeah, that was,
Please turn off the noise.
Okay, here we go. So the yellow-rumped warbler, often called the myrtle warbler, we have an eastern subspecies of the yellow-rumped, the myrtle warbler. That's a male. They're heading up to the boreal forests and to our mountaintops. They're very common breeders on the higher mountains of New England, New York. But they're closely accompanied by or followed by palm warblers on the upper right, which is really the second earliest warbler to appear in Vermont, New Hampshire, come through the upper valley. There are two races of the palm warbler. There's the yellow palm warbler and the western palm warbler. This is a yellow here, nice photo taken by Kent McFarland. I think it was the same day that we had that Phoebe fallout at Lake Runnymede. We had about 8 or 10 palm warblers that day. It's a ground-dwelling bird for the most part, stays low to the ground, has that rusty cap, bobs its tail a lot, wags its tail. That's a good field mark. And they are not staying here to breed. A few yellow-rumped warblers will stick around locally, not palms. They're heading up mostly to Canada. A few breed up in Vermont's Northeast Kingdom in the boreal habitats there. So moving down a little bit later now to the sort of early to mid warblers, black-throated blue, one of the signature northern hardwood breeding warblers here in northern New England. They're back. I've seen several. They have a nice, not
just
very.
Let it go. I don't even know how to shut the hell up.
I'm hearing somebody. So the black-throated blue, they're back. Look for them in a hardwood forest with an understory of striped maple and viburnum, hobble bush. They put their nests in the understory plants. They're not a canopy species. And then the Wilson's warbler, which is strictly a migrant. I saw my first one yesterday. Spry little bird. This is a male here with its little black cap. Quite a small warbler, even relatively. All the warblers are small. They don't stick around, and they're not common. They're never common. You never see more than one or two at a time, but it's always a treat when you do. So we're sort of now approaching the peak of warbler migration. The early species are back. Most of the mid-arriving species are back. And some of the later ones, though, are yet to come. Now, before I get to those later arriving warblers, I want to highlight two warblers. For you, for those of you who may be beginning birders, if there are two warblers that you need to know and can easily learn in Vermont, New Hampshire, this part of the world, here's one of them. This is an oven bird, which is almost more thrush-like in appearance than warbler-like, but it is a warbler, spends its time mostly on or close to the ground, puts its nest on the ground. Spectacular. It's named for the oven-shaped, it's a domed affair, beautiful nest, very hard to find. It's perhaps the most abundant warbler in our northern hardwood forests. They're everywhere, and their populations are doing reasonably well, it appears. I want to play you the oven bird's song because it is so distinctive that if you don't know it now, you could easily learn it probably by going out in your backyard and hearing it. I'm going to play it. It's a loud, emphatic song. People use the mnemonic teacher, 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 teacher. So here's the oven bird. Not musical particularly, but it sure is distinctive. So there's the oven bird. Another one that everybody should know if you're really paying attention to birds is this one, the common yellowthroat. This is a bird not of forested habitats, but of wet, brushy areas. And it's abundant, relatively speaking, for a warbler. I'm going to play its song, which is also very distinctive, easily heard, loud. Just have to get to it on my iPhone here. 1 second. Many of you already know it, I'm sure. But if you don't, give yourself an assignment to learn the common yellowthroat song in the next month. So here it is. Witchetty, witchetty. One more. Again, not terribly musical, but distinctive and memorable and easy to learn. And it's a very common bird, and it's a very striking bird. Look at it with that. This is a male with its black bandito mask, and they're everywhere in wet, brushy habitats. And they're back. They're one of the earlier arriving warblers. Okay, I think we're on to the yes. So now we're getting into some of the later arriving warblers that are heading up to the boreal forest, mostly of Canada. These four species, and I'll name each of them, only one of them nests in Vermont. And I'm going to start with the upper left, which is the Tennessee warbler. Not one of the more colorful wood warblers, but an abundant bird in the forests of Canada. Don't breed in Vermont, as far as we can tell. There are sporadic records that have been found, but none recent. And they have a very loud staccato song. I'm not going to play it, but they're going to show up this weekend. I guarantee it. Go out and just pay attention, listen. If you hear a loud song in the treetops, that's sort of a staccato, sharp trill, it could be a Tennessee warbler. The Cape May warbler on the lower left is a more showy bird for sure. This is a male with its chestnut cheek patch and its big, bold white wing bar. Really a spectacular bird. Not much of a songster, has a very thin, weak song. My aged ears can barely hear it anymore. Honestly, but they're showy. They love to feed on insects that are attracted to flowering trees, like apple trees are a magnet for Cape May warblers. So if you have a favored grove of apple trees, which are just about to start flowering and should coincide with the arrival of these guys, which I predict will be this weekend, you could have quite a show. We had a spectacular show of Cape May warblers last spring. These four species, well, really the three, the bay-breasted warbler in the upper right, I'll talk about in a second. These are species which are often referred to as spruce budworm specialists. Because they nest up in the boreal conifer forest, the spruce and fir forest, those forests are subject to periodic outbreaks of the spruce budworm, which is an insect pest that defoliates the trees. And birds like these three take advantage of the outbreaks, which provides abundant food for them, to raise bumper crops of young kids. And so when there are spruce budworm outbreaks, you tend to get population explosions of these boreal specialist warblers. And so there's one ongoing in Quebec. It may be winding down now, but the last two or three years there's been a substantial outbreak of spruce budworm. And we've had a real noticeable pulse of particularly Cape Mays and Bay Breasts in the spring and again in the fall, reacting or reflecting their population increases. So again, go out in the next week, 10 days, and these guys are going to be coming through. The bay-breasted warbler in the upper right is, again, like the Cape May, and they actually occur in very similar habitats. They're canopy birds in conifers when they're nesting. Has a quite a weak, thin, high-pitched song. I can't hear it anymore, really, unless it's 10 feet away. But they'll often also come to flowering crabapple trees and ornamental trees. So look for them. Now, on the lower right, this is also a boreal warbler, but it's one that actually nests in Vermont as well. This is a black pole warbler, bird which is abundant through all the way from Newfoundland to Alaska, but also nests in New England and New York on our mountaintops. It's one of the few boreal warblers that also has a distribution in New England on our mountaintops. So like the Bicknell's thrush, the only place you can find black pole warblers nesting in Vermont, New Hampshire, is on our higher mountain peaks. And here's one in a balsam fir tree. And we have studied black pole warblers, VCE has, on Mount Mansfield and elsewhere, and learned a great deal about them. Again, like the bay-breasted and Cape May, black poles have a thin, not a very distinctive, not a musical song. It's high-pitched and not very high frequency. Some of us birders with compromised hearing systems don't hear them so well anymore. But they're around, and there are lots of them on our mountaintops. So I'm going to digress on the next slide just a little bit to highlight some work that VCE did with colleagues that has documented an absolutely spectacular migration system of the black pole warbler. And it starts out with the fall migration. I know we're talking about spring, but fall does precede the spring migration. But anyway, to make a long story short, it was thought for years and years, based on a lot of circumstantial evidence, that black pole warblers undertake a nonstop transoceanic flight from the coast of Massachusetts, northern New England, Maine, New Brunswick. But nobody had the proof for that. People, bird banding stations, say in Massachusetts, would catch black pole warblers that were just sheathed in a roll of fat that were practically twice the weight that they would have been during their nesting season, you know, a month or two earlier. And then the birds would disappear and nobody would see them. They wouldn't appear in places like New Jersey or Virginia. Nobody would see them again. Although occasionally boats, often hundreds of miles at sea, would get these fallouts of black pole warblers. So it was thought that almost certainly they were making this non-stop transoceanic flight, but nobody had documented it. Well, we and colleagues put on little devices called geolocators, little backpacks on black pole warblers on Mount Mansfield and at a site in Nova Scotia. And we recovered them a year later. So these little devices, and I have to make this much shorter, sense light and can give you a position of the bird for each day that it's wearing that backpack as it progresses southward to its wintering grounds. And black holes winter on the northern part of South America. And then on its way back, and you have to recover the bird in a mist net the following year. That's the catch. But we did recover a number of the birds that we tagged. And when we looked at the data that these geolocators provided, it made abundantly clear that, in fact, they had undertaken these phenomenal nonstop across the ocean flights to their wintering grounds. And they do this in as little as 2 days, as many as three. It's really an extraordinary, heroic feat for a 12-gram bird that, you know, may end up weighing 20 grams by the time it leaves, sheathed in this fat, which will fuel this extraordinary flight. So they are really ounce for ounce, perhaps the champion among all bird migrants in what they achieve during their migration. And you can see that their return flight is actually more of an inland route and not a nonstop route. They make that return flight in stops and skips and jumps. All right. That was a digression, but I thought it was worthwhile. All right. Now, it's not all about warblers. It's not all about forest birds. There are other habitats that we should all pay attention to, and I can't cover them all, but I do want to touch on grassland habitats, open fields, meadows, because there are some real signature species of our grasslands, which are very vulnerable now because our grasslands have dwindled significantly over the years for many reasons. But there's a few trademark species that one really should go out and see. The eastern meadowlark on the left, singing away there, is a grassland species. We don't have many in the Connecticut River Valley here in eastern Vermont. They require pretty large expanses of grasslands, which we have few of here. There are a few, but it's a species which has declined precipitously in recent decades, and people are very concerned about meadowlarks. In fact, they're under consideration for listing in Vermont. Most of them in Vermont are in the Champlain Valley, up around Lake Champlain and the big agricultural grasslands there. And there's a whole host of issues that relate to how those grasslands are managed and whether those practices impact the bird populations. Well, we know they do, but that's another topic. So eastern meadowlark, beautiful, high-pitched song. And then the bobolink, upper right, it's also a real signature species of grasslands. They are capable of adapting to much smaller patches. So bobolinks are very common here in the upper valley of Vermont, New Hampshire, and elsewhere throughout New England. Many individual landowners that might only have 5 or 10 acres of grassland might have a pair or two of bobolinks. Very charismatic species with their bubbling, almost comical song, which the males deliver on the wing, flying above the grasses while the females observe from below. And they place their nest in the grass, on the ground, and like the meadowlarks, are vulnerable to haying practices. And then finally, the only other one I'm going to touch on, because it's a very common bird that everyone could easily find, is the savannah sparrow in the lower right. That's a grassland obligate, only nests in grassland habitats, open meadows and fields. Less conspicuous of a bird than the bobolink or the meadowlark, has a weak insect-like song, but they often perch up on fence posts and telephone wires, if there are any. And they're pretty easy to see if you look for them. So get out to some of our grasslands and see some of these species, which you're not going to find often in other habitats. And you might get lucky and see a vesper sparrow or a northern harrier, or who knows what else. There are other grassland species. All right. Now, let's see. Where are we next? Ah, yes. Well, I haven't touched on the sparrows. Sparrows are a whole group unto themselves. Any of you that are familiar with the North Branch Nature Center, our great colleague, Brian Pfeiffer, who's graced this slide, this show with some of his own photos, gave a talk recently on sparrows, and I encourage you to go listen to that. But if there's only one sparrow that you're going to seek out in the spring, have it be this one. This is a white-crowned sparrow. Really just a gorgeous, dapper bird. Does not stay here. Is strictly a migrant through Vermont. Doesn't nest anywhere in the eastern U.S. Is heading up to Canada, quite far north, actually. Not to the Arctic, but to the subarctic. They're very common in the west. They're resident populations all through California and the west coast. But here in the east, it's strictly a migrant, and it's just one of the birds. It doesn't stay here long. They're here now. I've seen several the last few days. You'll hear them sing occasionally as they're migrating through, the males. But look for them in open areas, often on the ground. They'll come to feeders, for any of you that are still feeding. Another bird that I'll mention, I don't have a slide, is the Lincoln sparrow, also a bird that really only migrates through here. They do nest in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, but they're headed further north. A relative of the song sparrow, same genus, Melaspiza, but a really handsome but much more furtive bird than the white-crowned sparrow, much more difficult to see. You're more likely to see one in the fall than the spring. So there are the sparrows. I hate to give them short shrift, but we can't cover everything today. But do look for a white-crowned sparrow in the next week, 10 days before they're gone. All right, so one of the great joys for me and for many birders of observing birds is learning, getting to know, and just hearing repeatedly their songs. And to really become a more seasoned birder, you've got to learn the songs. It's not hard, but it takes practice. It takes application. It takes patience and persistence. And it can be hard. And I would urge any of you that are just learning your bird songs and calls to not try to bite off more than you can chew. Do it gradually. Learn the common birds. Don't worry if you can't identify every one of the 15 different species that are singing around you. Go after one at a time and see the bird singing, get a good look at it, and that's going to ingrain it much more so in your memory, in your bank of knowledge. But here are three here that I just thought I'd highlight because these are three common species that for some beginning birders cause nightmares because their songs are somewhat similar, but they're definitely distinctive and identifiably different. And I just wanted to play each one of them and help you, just as an example, how to differentiate them. So I'm going to start with the American robin in the upper left. One of the early returning migrants, you all know when the robins come back, their cheery song makes us happy that it's spring. So I'm going to play the robin song first. These are three sort of sound-alike species. Here's the American robin. I love that song. I never get tired of hearing a robin sing. Okay, so it's, you know, there it is. You all probably know that. But I'm going to play the rose-breasted grosbeak now on the right of the screen. That is a woodland bird. They do come to feeders, but it's one that if you weren't careful, you might mistake for a robin. But it's pretty distinctive, and it's a song that you can often hear in our woodlands in the spring. And so I'm going to play it. It's a basically a faster, to me, more liquid version of the robin. Here we go. So the quality, I think you'd agree, is similar, but it's faster, it's more run together, and it's just different. And once you learn both of those, you won't be confused often by hearing one or the other. Now, the third one I want to play in this group of sound-alikes is the Scarlet Tanager on the lower left. That, to me, is a bit more distinctive, but some people have a hard time identifying it, telling it from a robin. To me, people often jokingly say a Scarlet Tanager sounds like a robin with a sore throat or a hoarse robin. So I'm going to play that now. One more. Again, similar quality, but it's a bit more burry, hoarse, I guess, and a bit slower than the rose-breasted. I'm going to play the call of the Scarlet Tanager as well, because that's one that you'll often hear. They're a canopy species. They nest high in the tops of deciduous trees, don't often come down low. So you're usually going to hear their songs up there, but this is a call that you might often hear. Chick-burr. That's a very distinctive call of the Scarlet Tanager. All right. So there's a little challenge for you. If you don't already know, differentiating the robin, the rose-breasted grosbeak, and the Scarlet Tanager song. All spring migrants that are all back or about to be any day. All right, we're winding down here. So there's a wonderful program. The Cornell Lab of Ornithology offers many, many tools for birders, eBird being one of them, as a great way to get out and record your observations, which makes them become part of the archive of information for science and conservation. I'd encourage anyone here to use eBird. But the Cornell Lab of Ornithology also produces BirdCast, which is basically a predictive map that they generate in 3-day increments that gives a forecast of what parts of the United States can expect to have a good bird migration. So you can see the blue and dark black are on the key are zones where they're predicting, and this is based on years of radar observations and then looking at the weather patterns and knowing how weather affects bird migration in the spring. We've had nothing but blue in the Northeast here for the last month. Honestly, except for that weekend I mentioned 2 weekends ago, there was a bit of orange. Well, they're predicting on Friday morning with a warm front coming and many birds that are now sort of, you could say, dammed up to our south, held up because there's been these persistent north winds, that there's going to be an influx. And so I would encourage everybody to get out if you can on Friday morning, and if not Friday, get out Saturday because it's going to be also good. There's a big pulse coming, and I don't want anyone to miss it. I'm not going to. That's for sure. So yeah, check out BirdCast. It's fun. It's not always. It's not the gospel. It's not always absolutely dead on accurate, but it gives you a good sense. And I haven't seen a color like that all spring, so it makes my blood boil thinking about what's to come. All right. So I'm just going to sort of finish up here, and then I'll be happy to take any questions. One of the really exciting aspects of bird migration for those of us that are perhaps a little more obsessed than others is the chance that you're going to encounter something unexpected. You know, birds being such mobile creatures, they can turn up anywhere, and they often do turn up in very unexpected places. So being out there as often as you can and paying attention and learning the birds so you know what to expect, you're going to find some oddballs showing up. And maybe it's just a rare species like this cerulean warbler in the upper left, which do breed in Vermont very sparingly, just a very few. Or the golden-winged warbler down in the lower right, also a pretty rare species in Vermont that I can go a whole year and not see a golden-winged warbler. But the other two, the Kentucky warbler on the lower left and the summer tanager, close relative of the scarlet, on the upper right, those are species which have no business being in Vermont and don't occur here with any regularity, but occasionally show up, you know, for whatever. Weather blows them off course. They just get disoriented. They're called vagrants often, birds that are outside their normal range, that aren't really where they want to be, didn't mean to come here, but are here. And they can really add a level of excitement to anyone's birding experience. So if you get out there, really pay attention, you're going to find some really cool, unexpected rarities. And that just adds spice to one's birding experience. So this literally is the last slide. And I just want to invite you all to participate in VCE's Backyard Bird Quest 2020, which takes place a week from Saturday. It is a fundraiser for us, but more importantly, this year, with all of us sheltering in place, we think it's a great opportunity for everyone to get outside their home, spend some time on their local patch, whether it's their deck or yard or, you know, the surrounding area, and just get to know the birds there and keep track of the birds. Use eBird if you can, and let us know what you find. We're really excited about this. Our birdathon is usually a quest where a team of VCE staff get in a van and drive around the Northeast Kingdom or somewhere else, and that's a lot of fun, but this is going to be a more intimate and I think more sustainable way to pay attention to birds. And May 23rd should be right during the peak of migration. Most of the residents will be here and singing. Many of the migrants will still be coming through in their height and their numbers. So it just should be perfectly timed to take advantage of the excitement of migration. So that's really all that's all I have. There's so much to talk about with migration, and I feel like I glossed over a lot, but I just wanted to give you all an overview and really more of a celebration of the wonderful phenomenon of spring migration. So with that, I'm going to stop sharing and go back to, let's see. Can you all see me now? Because I just wanted to point out a couple of resources that I want to hold up. First, you got to have a good pair of binoculars or a decent pair of binoculars. You can't really birdwatch without binoculars. And I would encourage anybody to spend as much money as you can to get a decent pair, because a suboptimal pair of binoculars are just going to frustrate you. And if you get a decent pair, it should be a lifelong investment. But you also need a field guide. And many of us have field guides on our apps now, or on our smartphones. But here's one. This is one of my favorites, the Sibley Guide. This is a second edition, the Sibley Guide to Birds. It's just a wonderful resource. Now, most people aren't going to lug this around. It doesn't fit in your pocket. I keep it in my car, actually, and refer to it when I need to. But I also have a pocket version of the Sibley Guide. And even though I mostly use my smartphone now and I have the Sibley app on my smartphone, this is a great thing to have as well. And for a beginning birder, I think having one of these, you can use Peterson. There's National Geographic. There's the good old Robin's Guide. There are many different options, and they're all good. But have a field guide. That's really important. And the last thing I want to mention is this classic book by Brian Pfeiffer and Ted Murin, two of Vermont's preeminent birders and naturalists. It's called Birdwatching in Vermont. It's a great, great resource. It's now a decade or so old, I think, but it's not out of date by any means. It'll tell you some of the hot spots for birding in different parts of the state. It gives you a list of birds and when to expect different species at what times of year. It's a great book that I would recommend to anybody, Birdwatching in Vermont. So now I'm going to shut up and just be available for questions if any of you have them. Thank you all for listening, and get out there and enjoy this migration.
So, Chris, it looks like we got two questions on warblers for you. Let me go back and find those really quick. One of them was asking about any known nestings or how frequently cerulean warblers nest in the state.
They are a regular but very infrequent and rare nester. I'm not sure that we have a very good handle on where they're nesting. I know there are some sites in the Champlain Valley. They used to nest along the Lamoille River in the floodplain. They tend to be in floodplain forests or in sort of southern hardwood type forests with oak. I know there's some pairs in Addison, Vermont. But I don't think there's a reliable site that I could point anyone to and say that's where you find nesting cerulean warblers. I don't know anyone.
I think during the last atlas, there was only one block that had confirmed nesting ceruleans in it. So even during that period when we were scouring the place, it was pretty dang rare.
It's a southern bird, for those of you who don't know the species. Its populations are mainly quite far to our south, from southern New England down through the mid-Atlantic. And it's a bird that's in conservation trouble. They're declining. They're a real concern, actually, everywhere. Oh, I see a question about prairie warbler. Shall I answer that? Prairie warblers, somebody asked it as a chat. Prairie warblers, that's another southern species. Vermont's at the northern extent of their breeding range, and they are most likely to be found in dry, scrubby habitats. Actually, one of the great places to look for prairie warblers is under power lines, power line corridors, overgrowing fields with junipers and spirea and saplings. We've lost a lot of those. There aren't as many as there used to be as Vermont's forests mature, succeed. That's where to look for prairie warblers. In eastern Vermont, around here, the Upper Valley, there's very few sites that I could point to where I could say you can go there and find a prairie warbler reliably. The Springfield Airport had a pair for many years at the south end of the airport. I don't know if they're still there or not.
Earlier, Chris, someone asked if you had any interesting tidbits about bay-breasted warbler you could share.
Other than the fact that I can't hear them anymore singing? well, it's a species that, again, you know, they come through over a fairly short period around the middle to the third week of May. Now, you know, this should be another good year for them. I would predict there to be higher than normal, whatever normal is, numbers because of the spruce budworm outbreak in Quebec. You know, spring migration, it's hard to say. Birds are less specific to the habitats they prefer during nesting when they're migrating. They're likely to come down anywhere where they can find food. So I couldn't tell you that you need to go to a spruce forest to look for a bay-breasted warbler, because you're as likely to see one in a flowering crab apple tree as you are anywhere else. I don't know what other kinds of insights I can offer. I can tell you that in the fall, the bay-breasted warbler, and many of these warblers, as most of you know, look very different in the fall than they do now in the spring in their breeding plumages. Bay-breasted warblers are a devil for some people to tell from blackpoll warblers. They look very, very similar in the fall when they come through in their drab
winter plumages. And that's a challenge. Their best way to tell them apart is by the color of their lower legs and feet, believe it or not. Black poles are yellow, bay-breasted are grayish.
And during the last breeding bird atlas, it looks like we didn't confirm them in any blocks, but we thought they might be breeding in some blocks in the Northeast Kingdom, and that's about it. So they're not much of a breeder in Vermont, right?
No, they're not. Nor is Cape May or Tennessee. We didn't talk. There's so many groups we didn't even touch on, like the flycatchers and the vireos. You know, the vireos, I have not heard of red-eyed vireo yet, which is absolutely shocking to me. I usually hear them middle or the end of the first week of May. And here it is May 13th today. And the vireos, they nest in my woods. I'm looking out the window. And if I had my windows open on a normal May 13th, I'd be hearing two or three of them. I haven't heard one yet. They're late. They're really late. But they're abundant in Vermont, New Hampshire. And that's a bird everyone should learn. The red-eyed vireo.
There's another question here, Chris, about bobolinks. A person was told they shouldn't mow their meadows until after August 1st, and they were just wondering a little bit more about mowing and bobolinks. Do you really have to wait till August 1st? Is that a good time, or you know, is there more details about that?
Well, if you can wait, I mean, if you're a landowner with grassland habitat who doesn't absolutely rely on the hay that you cut for forage for animals, it's absolutely recommended to wait as long as you can. If you can wait till October, then you're going to really allow, you know, butterflies and other insects and everything that lives in those grasslands to prosper. Yeah, August 1st, I mean, I think the official date that is used is more like July 17th. You can wait till at least the middle of July. That gives bobolinks and Savannah sparrows and meadowlarks, if you have them, more of a fighting chance to get their young out of the nest and fledged. Cutting before that is really putting those birds at risk. And we all know that some farmers have no choice. They just have to cut before then. What we urge is that people cut early and then late and avoid that middle period, mainly the month of June and early July, when these birds are actively nesting.
Another person, Chris, was noting that they have a yellow-rumped warbler at their suet feeder for about 10 days now. And they were wondering, like, is that thing going to stay or is it going to move on soon? I mean, it's been there for a long time.
I don't think it'll stay. I mean, if you look at our weather over the last 10 days, it's no wonder that the bird, first of all, is still here. Second of all, is eating fat, rich suet to keep warm and keep its energy supply up. I'd be very surprised if it stayed. I actually had a black-throated blue warbler at my feeder yesterday, that's the first time ever in 20 years living where I do. I have black-throated blue warblers in the woods, but they've never come to my feeder. I think birds are just a little stressed right now, insect-eating birds, in this current weather pattern.
Yeah, I know a few days ago when many of us got at least a little coating of snow, if not more, a lot of folks were reporting on Vermont eBird about hermit thrushes on the roadsides.
That's right.
There were people saying, you know, there were 20 to 30 hermit thrushes along the roads that they were walking, and that was a place where they could forage because there was less snow. So they came out of the woods because I think they were probably super hungry and tired of all that snow.
Yeah, there's some classic cases over the years. I remember, this is going back a long time now, in sort of early May, maybe a little bit earlier than now, there was a freak late season snowstorm that grounded a lot of scarlet tanagers, and people were seeing scarlet tanagers just lining the roadways, you know, with their scarlet and black wings on the snow banks. And it was really a amazing sight. And I'm sure some of them didn't survive. That's a risk that these migrant birds take, particularly the ones that come back early. Some of them are going to get hit by hard, prolonged nasty weather, and they're not going to survive. But enough of them obviously do that it's a behavior that keeps in the population. It doesn't get selected against and disappear.
There's a note here too, Chris, about someone said about now, shouldn't we have our feeders inside because of bear problems in Vermont? Do you know what the date is that the state tells people to put their feeders in? I think it's well past.
Oh, we're well past it. And, you know, I think if you're in an area that is prone to have bears, taking feeders in is definitely the right thing to do. What I do, honestly, is, and I'll keep mine out until the seed runs out, and that I'm getting close to that. I bring them in at night because the great majority of bear visits to feeders take place at night. You know, somebody could argue that I'm being irresponsible, and I would be hard pressed to defend myself. But I do know that bringing them in at night greatly reduces the chance of a bear visit. So I, you know, everyone has to make their own decision and make it as responsibly as you can. And I don't want to tell anyone they can't feed birds. But if you're in an area that is prone to have bears, then you need to really think about it carefully.
Just a couple notes here. Gretchen down, she lives down in southwestern Vermont in the banana belt. She hasn't had red eyes either yet. So that's interesting. Maybe not even down there. And a couple other people have also noted that when the snow came out, they were flushing lots of hermit thrushes along the road. So that must have been quite a spectacle of that day. I didn't get out and see that, but that must have been something else.
I didn't either. Yeah.
I'm not seeing much else. If anybody else has any questions and wants to pop it up on the chat box, happy to keep Chris here until his lunchtime arrives. But if there's any more questions, that's great. If not, I don't know. Emily, do you have anything else?
No, the only thing that I'll add is that, you know, if you joined partway through, or you know someone else who's really interested in watching, this webinar will be posted on the Vermont Atlas of Life recorded events page sometime later today. So keep an eye out for it there if you want to catch it again.
Well, I appreciate everyone's interest and enthusiasm, and I look forward to hearing that some of you have been out finding some of these birds that we've been talking about.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I just encourage everybody to pop on Vermont eBird and check it out. And there's a couple good tutorials. It's easy to use and lots of great information there about what's arriving and what's coming. So get out and watch them. Thanks, Chris.
All right. Thank you. Good birding, everybody. Bye-bye.